Hello and welcome back to Double Take, the Newton Investment Management podcast by and for investors. I'm Rafe Lewis, Newton's head of specialist research.
And I'm Newton investigative research analyst Jack Encarnacio. You know, we're coming up on 3 years since offices around the world sealed their doors shut because of COVID-19, and the workforce shifted drastically to remote at-home setups. In those early days, it really was hard to envision what would come of the commercial real estate that was left behind.
Yeah, not to mention all these home offices filled with toys and cat litter boxes and stuff. So, Jack, here we are, the new normal setting in. And according to the commercial real estate firm Marcus & Millichap, as more employees work remotely more often, less office space is needed. It seems like simple math, right? And yet coming into 2022, occupied office space in the U.S. was short 126 million square feet of pre-pandemic levels, and absorption of that vacant space has been modest since.
At the same time, a new generation of younger people and eventually their managers have entered the workforce, and they have different ideas of the importance of physical office space and how far from those offices they expect employers to allow them to work. This, of course, has ramifications for the urbanization trend observed before COVID and the development potential that this all might unlock for suburban areas, businesses designed to support the worker of the future and the like.
Yeah, I think it seems safe to say that the outlook for commercial real estate has been dramatically altered by what's happened in the past 36 months. But, you know, does anyone really know how and how long, right? So to help us triangulate where this important asset class is heading, you know, we're turning to a couple of very well-placed guests. And right now, we're pleased to welcome Alan Pontius, who's Senior Vice President and National Director for the aforementioned Marcus & Millichap's office and industrial divisions. And he's a true veteran of the commercial real estate game. He joins us now from San Francisco. Al, welcome to Double Take.
Well, Rafe and Jack, thank you very much for having me today. It's certainly a topic of conversation that is very much remaining in debate. Maybe a little bit more visibility is formed, but I look forward to getting into the conversation. And thanks again for letting me join you.
Well, Alan, it's really, really great to have you. And I know you've been interacting with a lot of clients on this front and this theme in recent weeks. So really interested in your top of mind thoughts that the post-COVID normal is coming into view for commercial real estate. And I wonder if we're where you expected us to be when we were back in the throes of the pandemic.
You know, I would say, Jack, probably not exactly where, because this has been an open debate for a while. It continues to be an open debate. There are no conclusions. There might be a little bit more information, but you have camps that believe office of the past is gone for good. Just forget about it. And you have at the other extreme, the camp that says, just give it a little bit of time and things are going to look a lot more like they did in the past. Both are extreme views, really, to make a point. It's going to be somewhere in the middle. I know that even sounds vague, but the complexity of this conversation, I'll say it one more time, is it leads to ongoing debate. You have an employer view. You have an employee view. They are not always the same. You have urbanization. You have suburbanization. These are all components. There's another thing that to me is very lost in the whole big picture debate is the news always focuses on the largest of tenants, whether it's a huge bank, whether it's a gigantic global technology concern, and every other large format business you could think of. These companies have to go through very complex HR discussions, what's the right mix, what's the right balance, how do we distribute our office use across the globe? And that conversation, I'm suggesting, is much more detailed, much more complex, I'll say again, than the regional firm that might have one location or might be getting ready to select one location. Maybe there's anywhere from 5 to 25 employees. And that decision-making process about space in terms of location and build-out is different than the gigantic conglomerate, because that company, this I'll call it smaller format regional company is in many regards about expanding their business, in some cases, surviving in the business, in other cases, growing an already successful business. But the HR discussions are not nearly so deep, not nearly so detailed, and the space decisions are just very different. So you can find buildings in the marketplace very easily where you go in and you say, wait a minute, this looks like it's always been. What's all this talk about work from home and nobody's coming into the office? So I'm not trying to suggest that work from home is an overstated phenomena that's going to burn off in a minute or two. That is not my point. My point is simply there are so many different compositions of companies and correspondingly so many different compositions of how space allocation plays out. It is not quite so simple as a work from home full time, work in the office full time, or anything in between. I hope that makes sense.
I think it makes sense, but I guess what I'm still wondering about coming into this new normal is, let's say you have a company with 5,000 workers, and in the old days, 5,000 workers showed up to whatever this workplace was. Since we're talking office right now in this particular part of the conversation, let's stick with that. 5,000 sure. office workers in the old normal. The new normal, let's say you still have 5,000 workers, maybe even have 5,500 now, but call it 2,500 at any given time are going into work. And the other 2,500, whatever, 3,000 back at home. Do they need the same footprint that they had before? Are they rationalizing? Are they downsizing? And what does that mean for the value of that asset?
Great question. Let me pose a question back. What happens if they all show up on the same day?
Yeah, that's pretty ugly.
Here's the point of that question. My observation is that most companies are trying to move towards a schedule. It doesn't really work for the mission of the company to have people show up whenever they feel like it. And again, if they all show up on the same day and I shrunk my footprint measurably, now what do I do? Sorry, we're at capacity today? Unlikely. So I can provide examples of large companies that are absolutely consolidating their space in anticipation of a certain amount of people being in. And they've consolidated and significantly upgraded the quality of the space, because one of the things that companies are looking at is how can my space itself be attractive and cause employees to want to congregate. But coming back to your question specifically, it's not so easy as to simply scale back because only half come in on one day and half on another day. That is total disorganization. So what is happening with companies is, to varying degrees, they're coming up with Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and other formats in between designed to cause people to be together in an organized fashion. Other companies are looking at whatever team you're on, you'll go to the cadence of your team. So it's important to note that it's not just random show up when you feel like it. And there's going to have to be space planning around the notion that in some organized fashion, a high percentage, if not all of our workforce, will be in on the same days. And I can't really shrink my footprint in that kind of a context.
But Al, I have to say, though, that's a little worrisome from the point of view of the folks who might own a big, fat office building, because it sounds like with a little bit of scheduling work, which is probably cheap, you could possibly dramatically downsize your footprint if you're a white collar business.
And we are seeing that play out in the large companies. We are seeing very typically, now this is mainly an urban phenomenon, so this would be more of a New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles to a smaller degree, Chicago. In these marketplaces that have pronounced major downtowns, a Seattle would fit into this category, you certainly see the consolidation moves having an impact predominantly on the older buildings, because these consolidations in the example of a very large company are typically occurring into the absolute newest, best-in-class assets. So you're seeing winners and losers on the basis of, in the urban centers, the absolute most modern, most expensive, I might add, assets that are attracting the largest, most creditworthy companies. And so I have seen in examples recently in interviews that I've conducted with clients who are also building tenants. In a couple of cases, there were consolidations, but I can tell you two specific cases, or rather, I can reference two specific cases. In each case, very large financial firms, in both cases, moved to newer, higher quality space, and in both cases, expanded their footprint. So I would be willing to agree that the net impact on office, particularly in urban centers, the net impact large companies on office today is generally shrinking footprints. But again, I just gave you two examples of expanding footprints. So this is going to continue to be a debate, but because of the debate and because of what appears to be a more flexible working environment going forward, that feels at the moment like shrinking overall demand, older assets in the urban center are being hurt the most at the moment. And consequently, investors are very cautious today as it relates to new office building acquisitions. And the demand for yield is substantially higher than it was a year or 2 years ago. So there's plenty of volatility, but there's plenty that remains to play out.
I wonder, Alan, what you expect to happen in your crystal ball to the older, more distressed space that might be that much less desirable. Will it be converted? Will it eventually come back online? How do you envision that unused space?
Again, it's the urban core where the largest challenges exist. And it's going to play out in a variety of ways. There will be some distress, no doubt about it. And there will be assets that are going to either become lender owned, or I'll call it lender partnered. And what would have to happen is the basis on these assets will have to come down in order to justify the cost of conversion. Others, again, older format properties, others won't really be suitable in their format to a conversion. And the big conversion being discussed right now is conversion of older dated office retrofitted into multifamily. And that will happen, but it won't happen across the board. Again, the basis or the physical composition of the structure won't allow for it. If the physical composition of the structure allows for it, the basis in many cases will have to come way down to justify that conversion cost. In other cases, though, there will be, you know, one of the examples that I drew upon earlier was an older vintage asset, but the space which I walked was built out to accommodate much more conference room space, much more open or shared space, a very high-end dining facility. And it was just absolutely, absolutely beautiful space. But this was in an older building. This is not a building that was constructed post 2015. Mm-hmm. This was a building that was constructed post 1990. So my point is the other option is substantial retrofitting of an existing asset to modernize it to modern expectations. And some buildings will have difficulty because of their systems making that full move. So we're seeing again, the largest companies, the highest credit pay up for the most modern assets in a given urban nature.
That makes plenty of sense to me. But Alan, I wonder, when I hear your commentary, looking into 2023, cost of capital probably still going up as the central banks are, increasing their rates. Commodity prices clearly kind of volatile. So when you think about even just doing construction work at all, that starts to get expensive. Recession likely. Maybe almost guaranteed. How does that macro, impact demand, and how nervous, I guess, are
Right.
some of your asset owners?
Rafe, it delays. It delays the rebound. Had we stayed on a trajectory that we were on, moving to, if you will, a post-pandemic orientation to health and an interest rate environment that had not completely spiked, I might have said 23 would be a notable year of recovery. These are very, very difficult forecasts to make. I will say we have already seen, and this would fly in the face, by the way, of some of our back and forth even this morning for me anyway. And that is, we are seeing positive absorption, modest but positive. And we are seeing more absorption in the suburban environments that we are seeing in the urban environments, going back again to my comments on urban. So, to your question specifically, with that as a backdrop, we're already seeing what you would call recovery signs. I would anticipate that the challenges economically that we have, the interest rate environment that we have, you mentioned a likely recession. The Fed appears to be committed to influencing a recession. In an effort to somehow slow down this incredibly buoyant employment market that we've been in for now an extended period of time and a historically low unemployment rate. So, okay, if we are going into a recessionary period and if interest rates remain high at the same time, this is going to delay us. So I think that 2023 is, from the office point of view, preparing itself to be spotty with continued absorption gains, but more modest than we might have expected going into the year. And the suburban markets will outperform the urban markets. That's probably the best commentary or at least forecast I can offer, that we're now probably delaying what level of recovery we might have experienced in 2023. This is now being pushed out.
Alan, what did you see in terms of the degree to which corporate tenants had rents, essentially, locked in existing agreements before COVID threw everything for a loop? How did that all suss itself out? In general, did you see a whole lot of folks agreeing to reopen rental agreements to push out guaranteed rents, maybe at a lower rate for more years? And when are those coming up? Or did folks just grin and bear and either pay or not pay their rents when there was so much disruption, which in a lot of ways continues today?
Actually, kind of a multi-part question, and I'll try and break it down a little bit. First, collections through the pandemic remained outstanding. It was, in some ways, probably a little surprising. I mean, you have office space, you're paying office rent, and yet collections remain high. The nature of office tenancy is largely based on service. So, as it turned out, office rent collections remained robust throughout the period. I mean, in excess of 90%. So there were examples, but the collection rate was great. There were, on occasion, certainly discussions about what are your plans, especially on the more on the shorter term leases. If leases were already 5, 10 years remaining, frankly, there wasn't a whole lot of conversation. But in shorter dated terms, you would have conversation about what do you intend to do? Do you intend to keep your space? And to the extent there was a desire by both tenant and landlord to resize, in those cases, there was an extension of term in trade-off for shrinkage of space. And in other cases, there were short-term leases made because nobody knew exactly where the dust was going to settle. Consequently, our lease is up, I don't want to commit to another 5 years or 10 years. I'd like to commit to another year at this time while we try and figure it out together. And a lot of those deals were made. We're pretty much past that now. And now we're in what I call a more normalized lease renewal discussion. Do you want to renew? Do you want to renew subject to different terms? That is to say less space, more space. So it's a more normalized conversation now, certainly with overall demand being less than you would generally want it to be. Positive absorption, but depth of demand, depth of new leases being signed, depth of expansions is still much more modest than one might have expected this far removed from the pandemic. And when I say that, I realize that we're in the some element of the pandemic still. People wear masks. People are conscious about health. There's varying degrees of guidance on what to do on vaccines, not to do. So it still remains a bit of a cloudy picture, and it's there's still health consideration in place, and that does continue to delay big decisions to the extent both company and landlord can delay them.
Because you mentioned, you know, the still present concern about health and things like that. Have you seen, and did we see, sort of a raft of HVAC upgrades and other things to improve circulation in buildings? I know there was so much discussion about that in the earliest days of the pandemic, about how to make office workers more comfortable back in a work environment. And there was a lot of promise and hope around, you know, real full-scale upgrades in that regard. Have we seen a lot of that? Did that sort of fall by the wayside, the enthusiasm for that, as people
became more? 100% has not fallen by the wayside, but there is huge variance in how it's being addressed. And just as a case in point, I was in New York recently, and one of the things that would happen in a, call it, full pandemic response is, you know, limitations to how many people in the elevator, stand on your circle, if you will. There would be big lines because of limitations to the elevator. And I didn't experience that at all. It was a completely normal check-in process for me at the security table, completely normal move into the elevator. No lines, no hang up any differently from any other period of time. Now, you could argue some of that is the return to the office and how limited occupancies are compared to capacity. You could argue that that's a contributor to that. But what I would say back to your question is that is exactly why the largest companies are highly attracted to the newest and most modern buildings, because they want to provide their employees with the absolute best in class across the board. And across the board means airflow and just generally health concerns, no doubt about it. But I would say the race to that, the aggressiveness that all buildings are pursuing, upgraded HVAC and so on, the harsh economic realities are such that that is not a 100% across the board thing. So while I will not say it's died off and not being discussed, yes, it's a consideration. It's why the newest buildings are winning, but cost considerations get into exactly how far any given landlord will go on an existing older building.
Very interesting. Well, it sounds like some of the pressure that we big investors are putting on corporates to treat their human capital well might be paying off. But let's have you take off your office hat for a second and put on your industrial hat. You know, we're a thematic investment shop, and you know, we actually even had a podcast episode not long ago where we discussed one of our themes here, which is the reshoring of you know, a lot of the industrial jobs that have moved offshore, thanks to NAFTA, et cetera. And so I wonder what you're seeing in industrial land in the new normal. What's your expectation for 23 and beyond?
So reshoring is exciting because that's net positive to the industrial landscape. But it's more of a headline news today than it is in terms of actually playing out with demand. So let me explain. You know, rejiggering the supply chain takes some time. The good news is there's a the good news for US industrial anyway, is that there's a recognition, a widespread recognition, that supply chains were disrupted in large part because of dependency on offshore operations. And there is a clear bias. If you talk to logistical and transportation CEOs, there is a clear bias to make sure that doesn't happen to this extent ever again. Does that mean globalization is done? No. It just means mitigation strategies are going to be put in place, which means reshoring or nearshoring to attempt to make sure the severity of this logistical nightmare doesn't repeat itself in any way. So that's good. That's net positive. Also, offshoring in the first place, it in many ways was created by extreme discrepancy in cost of labor and cost of overall production. And those costs have narrowed greatly, and business efficiencies and technology have contributed to that narrowing, if you will. Again, all accretive to reshoring, but it is going to take time. It's probably not going to be felt meaningfully for several years in terms of overall impact on supply and demand, but it does make manufacturing facilities or manufacturing sites more relevant. But coming back to industrial at large, ours is a distribution industrial environment. What has caused the incredible run-up in industrial occupancy, as a result, rates, as a result, investor demand? The incredible run-up is a byproduct of demand for goods and an extraordinarily strong consumer environment. So you've had massive expansion. We have today the lowest vacancy rate at just under 4%, the lowest historical vacancy rate that industrial space has ever seen. We are seeing signs now of a modest degree of pullback in space demand, meaning instead of multiple tenants for every space, particularly the newest, most modern spaces, we're now seeing the depth of that demand thin out. We continue to see rates increasing, but at a slower curve going forward. So there is a bit of pullback in the space in terms of overall demand characteristics from where we were 9 to 12 months ago, which was even white hot is probably not a strong enough term. But we continue to have an extraordinarily strong industrial environment. Reshoring is a positive, but reshoring is not the instigator, if you will, of the strength of the industrial market.
Finally, for you, Al, as we look out on 2023, what strikes you here in the few remaining months of 2022 as the critical decisions that those who rent out office and industrial space and those who lease it out, those who rent it as tenants, are going to have to face? Is there anything that, if we have this conversation at the end of 2023, that you think we will have learned, boxes we will have checked, answers we will have surfaced?
Well, remember, I'm coming from the orientation of a financial advisor, an investment advisor. Our company doesn't engage in leasing space, so we're not representing directly landlords to lease their space, nor are we representing tenants directly to find space solutions. Ours is from the orientation of an investor. And of course, within that, though, we understand what those underlying conversations are. With a pending recession, the tenant demand is going to move progressively to a more cautious posture. So when I'm not forced to make a decision on my space, I'm going to move slowly. So expansion discussions in office for sure will be slower to form, I believe, as a result of expectations about interest rates and the economy at large, as a more cautious view of the future sets in until things become more clear about a more stabilized interest rate environment and a more stabilized inflationary and economic environment. So those who can wait are probably going to pause on new space decisions. On the industrial side, if consumer demand remains strong and the employment market suggests that it can, the industrial side decisions will be made faster. But as I alluded to just a few minutes ago, overall demand is becoming a little bit more cautious. Landlords and tenants are coming to faster decisions. The office landlord is going to get close to their tenants. They're going to understand with clarity, what do you need? What do you want? How are your employees feeling? What are they saying about coming back to the office? What are you saying about your expectations about coming back to the office? Landlords are going to be very much in tune with their tenants. Not to say the industrial landlords won't as well. I realize I'm skipping back and forth right now, but the office market is, the scales favor the tenant right now. In the industrial market, the scales still favor the landlord right now, although a greater sense of balance is setting in. So what I would forecast for 2023 is the industrial market remains strong with or without a recession. The supply-demand fundamentals are simply too good. There may be markets that are supplying hard right this minute, and they may wind up with buildings that sit longer than they might have anticipated going into it because there's been a degree of cooling. And on the office side, I believe the urban markets are going to remain somewhat muted in terms of absorption rates. The suburbs will outperform. I fully expect that. But office in general is still going to have, from the viewpoint of the landlord, less tenant demand, less robust tenant demand than they might have expected heading into 2023. And I think it's because of a complicated economic picture. So I think that office is going to continue to be a spotty asset by asset situation.
A terrific roadmap to 2023 in commercial real estate, courtesy of our guest here on Double Take, Alan Pontius. He is from the firm Marcus & Millichap, their office and industrial division's senior vice president in that capacity. Thank you so much for joining us, Alan, and lending your perspective on Double Take.
One more time, Jack and Rafe, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure joining you today.
Joining us now from the global commercial real estate services giant, JLL, is Sean Coughlin. He's JLL's global head of research and strategy for capital markets, and Jeremy Kelly, who's a director in global research for JLL out of London. Jeremy has nearly four decades of experience in commercial property market analysis, and over the last 15 years, he's built JLL's flagship cities research program, advising corporates, developers, and investors on their global strategies and expansion plans, as well as advising city governments on city competitiveness. So we would love to welcome Sean Coughlin and Jeremy Kelly to Double Take. Thanks, guys, for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Oh, it's so great to have you guys. You know, Jeremy, why don't we start with you from a 30,000 foot view, maybe even higher. Let's go to a satellite's view of the planet. You know, the narrative coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic was that the nature of cities as we have known them for the last century is changing permanently. People are moving out. They want their little yard. Office towers emptying out, cats and dogs living together, mayhem. Can you kind of tell us whether there's any accuracy to the narrative? That would be the main question today.
Okay, I'm happy to take that. I guess during the depths of the pandemic, many were actually predicting the death of the city and that there was going to be a sort of mass exodus, and that's certainly not happening. And I think the conversation is a lot more nuanced nowadays. I think an important point to sort of flag is that although it feels a long time since the depths of the pandemic, many of the sort of disruptions that it created have yet to sort of properly settle down. So, you know, and there's still quite a lot of ambivalence about the direction of travel. So on the one hand, you hear many corporates announcing that hybrid work, remote working is here to stay, and others are firmly requesting their employees go back to their offices. And added to the mix, there's a sort of anecdotal evidence that the more recessionary conditions of today are tipping the balance from employees to employers, and so encouraging more office-based work. And then you've got the further complication of the ESG agenda and how that is also starting to impact work-life balance, where people work, the types of workplaces, the types of living environment that people want. And I guess that there's probably two big themes that I would flag. One is at the macro level, there's certainly been evidence of more distributed living, more distributed business activity. And so we've seen some move to more affordable locations, which has meant that selective second and third tier cities, selective suburbs, have probably been the big winners of this sort of reshuffling of activity. But then on the other side, at an asset level, you've got the flight to quality, the fact that that corporates are gravitating to assets that are in vibrant locations, that have the conditions to attract talent and have the ESG credentials. And these are in short supply. So you've got the one hand, you've got distributed activity, but also that's concentration into the high value, high quality assets and locations.
Very interesting, Jeremy. So when we think about the mentality of the worker and how that might have changed as hybrid work became the norm for so long, and companies are trying to suss out how much space do we really need? Can we shrink our footprint and save on real estate costs because if we schedule things correctly, perhaps half or less or more of our employees on any given day will not be physically in the office. Is that conversation reached sort of a nadir? Have real estate arrangements around, you know, rental agreements and things reached a point in the cycle where folks have made their decision, we are shrinking or we are not? Or is there still a lot of decision-making to be made on that front as employers interact with employees about what makes sense?
I think, to be candid, I think there's still the jury is still out for many corporates as to what their workplace requirements will be. There's certainly a recognition that things have changed very dramatically and that we will not go back to old ways. And so corporates are exploring the new models of office occupancy, exploring how hybrid work is going to shape out over the next decade, exploring their location strategies. You know, is it in the CBD? Should we be looking more to distributed activity? And every occupier seems to be having a different solution to that. So it's certainly not a one size fits all. And whilst we are seeing evidence of an overall contraction in the net requirement of offices in developed economies, you know, we're seeing that a big difference between demand for that high quality space and the grade B and C space, which is increasingly looking obsolete and difficult to let.
Very interesting. Let's put a pin for a moment in that quality question and move to Sean, because Sean, you know, let's add the complication here of what would appear to be possibly a, if not a global recession, certainly a European and possibly North American recession. We've got central banks raising the costs of capital rather dramatically. So what is all this doing to demand and valuations and transaction activity?
Great question. You know, we've been seeing a moderation in bidding dynamics in the commercial real estate markets really since the US in May. It started in the summer in Europe, and it started in Asia probably at the start of the fall. And the reality is that as a result of a lot of the macroeconomic shifts that we've been experiencing, in particular, the fact, to your point, that more central banks are tightening monetary policy, in particular in the Western world. And that has been increasing rates at a pace that we haven't seen for some time, that is impacting the risk premium associated with investing into property markets. It's impacting returns and it's impacting valuations. So we're at a point today where more groups, more capital, let's call it, is facing some degree of constraint, especially if you think about a lot of your major institutions that drive a lot of capital flows in real estate. And that is impacting transactional activity. We began to see that pop up when we looked at data from the third quarter, and we're expecting that to be apparent into 2023 as well, as a lot of groups are focused at looking at where yields shift and how to think about risk premiums in real estate, but also trying to understand how different sectors are performing, how the demand side of some of those sectors may shift as we see economic shifts. So groups can underwrite assets with more conviction and more confidence. But with that said, there is a lot of capital that remains very focused on accessing property. We had some data come out more recently that validated the longer-term shift in allocations towards alternatives and real estate is very much intact and should increase further. So what that means, which is quite different than what happened in the financial crisis, is that as we do begin to see shifts in the markets, as we see capital get more confident in how they should be underwriting those assets, I think we'll begin to see capital move quickly, in particular as we begin to see some more dislocation evident in the investment markets in property.
Sean, could I ask you, as we enter 2023, someone sitting in your seat, what will you be watching for signs that, all right, this is how this whole thing is going to shape out? This is the degree to which, you know, a typical real estate investment will play out in terms of expected occupancy, in terms of cash flows from rent. Do you expect, I mean, if you had to think of your crystal ball here, that by 2023, it's going to start to feel more like 2019 again? Or are you sort of oriented toward a much different altered picture than what you remember?
It's a great question. You know, I'm a big believer in following demand. And I think demand, in to some degree, starts with what Jeremy was speaking to, which is looking at the demand for an office space, looking at the demand for a rental residential building, looking at the demand for a retail space, and thinking about how shifts in the economy would impact that. It's interesting because demand for office spaces have been structurally impacted as a result of the pandemic. And I think a lot of that still has to shake itself out, to Jeremy's point. You know, historically, there's been quite a strong correlation between shifts in the employment conditions and shifts in office occupancy. That relationship has been broken over the past few years. You look at employment conditions, that also tends to be fairly correlated with fundamentals in the rental residential or multi-housing sector. and you're seeing record levels of occupancy. You probably saw record levels of rent growth as well over the past year in that sector. Yet we're seeing economic shifts that will likely begin to impact the confidence and whatnot in the demand side of that sector, but also in consumer confidence to go out and spend money. So I think there's a lot of things at play. I think we should be watching very closely the demand side of the markets. I also think we should be watching very closely the demand side of the capital markets, which is impacted by shifts in the rate environment. Inflation is impacting how groups are underwriting the growth of potential cash flows on an investment opportunity. demand in the capital markets is also looking at, you know, strategically which markets they want to be accessing, which sectors should they be accessing and growing in or decreasing their exposure to. And that very much will be in response to some of those demand shifts on the kind of fundamental side that I was talking about to start. So I think looking at the demand side is most critical. I think that we are entering a really challenging time period, but also a time period of a lot of opportunity. And I think in a period of change comes opportunity, and we'll see groups begin to pivot strategies. And that to me is quite exciting. In particular, as we're seeing markets and assets challenged by the current climate, and you'll begin to see which assets and which markets are perhaps outperforming, and that very well could be a different profile of asset than the asset which was outperforming in 2019.
So speaking of the assets, Jeremy, earlier we put a pin in your comment about kind of a flight to quality when it came to the kinds of properties that might be doing a bit better right now. I wasn't sure if you were referring to location or maybe just, you know, the modernness and newness of the building, maybe both. And I'm wondering kind of what is creating that cleavage, and do you expect it to last, or is this just a temporary phenomenon?
Yeah, I was referring really both to the asset and the location. The asset needs to be able to attract the talent back into the office. So it's important for talent attraction and retention. The asset needs to appeal to the demands from employees for greater health and wellness and environmental credentials. That's also an important factor. But it's about the location, about high amenity, high energy locations, whether that is in traditional re-emerging CBDs or in these high energy sort of innovation oriented hotspots that certainly are coming back to life at a faster pace than many other part submarkets. And I do think that's a trend that will continue. I do think that we're going to see the CBD come back to life. We are seeing that in a number of CBDs already. But having said that, I really do think that it may take actually more than one business cycle for central business districts, for traditional cores to sort of redefine themselves in the new sort of urban ecosystem. Because CBDs need to be far more mixed use and have higher levels of amenity. And so I do think that there's going to be a continued polarization of activity towards these favored assets in high amenity, high energy locations.
And when you think about those high energy locations, similar to the question we asked Sean, Jeremy, and you look out on 2023 and beyond, do you ever expect to envision the same or observe the same picture that you remember pre-pandemic? And if not, what are the subtle differences in your mind's eye that, we're going to see?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. You know, I can see that there's going to be a huge amount of continued amount of flux within our urban environment that's both about changing workplace and work style preferences, but also the responses to the climate emergency. We've just come through COP27. It's again, once again, sort of focused minds on the climate emergency. And I think we're really going to see increasing pressures on the real estate industry to step up to decarbonize real estate. And regulations are really going to start to ramp up that will force the pace of change and force owners of real estate to decarbonize their buildings. So I think that's a factor that will only rise in importance over the coming few years, which we didn't necessarily have before the COVID pandemic. It really wasn't sort of front and center of the conversation.
Well, so long COVID, not just a diagnosis for humans, but for the commercial real estate markets. Well, Sean Coughlin and Jeremy Kelly of JLL, thank you so much for joining us here on Newton's Double Take.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Investment Management North America, LLC, NIMNA, or the firm, is a registered investment advisor and subsidiary of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation, BNY Mellon. The firm was established in 2021, comprised of equity and multi-asset teams from an affiliate, Mellon Investments Corporation. The firm is part of a group of affiliated companies that individually or collectively provide investment advisory services under the brand Newton, or Newton Investment Management, Newton. Newton currently includes NIMNA and Newton Investment Management Limited, Newton Limited. Any statements of opinion constitute only current opinions of NIMNA, which are subject to change and which NIMNA does not undertake to update. This publication, or any portion thereof, may not be copied or distributed without prior written approval from the firm. Statements are correct as of the date of the material only. This document may not be used for the purpose of an offer or solicitation in any jurisdiction or in any circumstance in which such offer or solicitation is unlawful or not authorized. The information in this publication is for general information only and is not intended to provide specific investment advice or recommendations for any purchase or sale of any specific security. Some information contained herein has been obtained from third-party sources that are believed to be reliable, but the information has not been independently verified by NIMNA. NIMNA makes no representations as to the accuracy or the completeness of such information. No investment strategy or risk management technique can guarantee returns or eliminate risk in any market environment, and past performance is no indication of future performance. The indices referred to herein are used for comparative and informational purposes only and have been selected because they are generally considered to be representative of certain markets. Comparisons to indices as benchmarks have limitations because indices have volatility and other material characteristics that may differ from the portfolio, investment, or hedge to which they are compared. The providers of the indices referred to herein are not affiliated with NIMNA, do not endorse, sponsor, sell, or promote the investment strategies or products mentioned herein, and they make no representation regarding the advisability of investing in the products and strategies described herein. Any forward-looking statements speak only as of the date they are made and are subject to numerous assumptions, risks, and uncertainties, which change over time. Actual results could differ materially from those anticipated in forward-looking statements.
If distributed in the UK, EMEA, Australia, New Zealand, this podcast is issued by Newton Limited and may be deemed a financial promotion. Newton Limited is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, 12 Endeavour Square, London, E20, 1JN, in the conduct of investment business. Registered in England, number 01371973. NIM is also registered as investment advisors with the Securities and Exchange Commission's, SEC, to offer investment advisory services in the United States. If distributed in Canada, This podcast is issued by either Newton Limited, which is availing itself of the International Advisors Exemption, IAE, in the following Canadian provinces: Alberta, British Columbia, Ontario, and Quebec. The IAE is in compliance with National Instrument 31-103, registration requirement, exemptions, and ongoing registrant obligations, or NIMNA, which is availing itself of the IAE in the following Canadian provinces: Alberta, British Columbia, and Manitoba. The IAE is in compliance with National Instrument 31-103, registration requirements, exemptions, and ongoing registrant obligations.